We have with the fact of the multiplication of phonetic or vocal echoes of the world, something which would be the kind of multiplication of transport. Is a procedure, a process of transport, maybe of translations of the same sound, combined with many other, and is literally what I mean by echoes. And in a semantic point of view, there is something like that, is to say that each signifier, each word, is a translation of other words. There is here a translation, but in fact, translation is an echo, a semantic echo of many other words used in the past. And this broken orchestra, which becomes a word, is the effect of its poetic use. We will see that in fact there is something equivalent in the relationship between the comment and the poem. For example, we will see that there is something like that, something here which would be the comment, and here the poem. With a permanent interconnection between meaning and sound, like between command and poem, and also a permanent division between them, and a permanent autonomy of the music from the meaning, or a permanent autonomy of different meanings relating to the first one. And this strange poetic system would be something which is systematically organized by Juan de la Cruz's poem. We will see that in fact it's metalinguistic experience and also theory of the language as having this poetic function of coming from elsewhere. We will see this point the next time with the comment and the sources, but maybe there are some discussions or some questions. It would be more interesting to discuss a little on this problem. My question would be that finally the poem is unveiling a metalinguistic structure of the language, either by its musical function as an echo, or by the question of this double fact that it's each word. The strange combination of two qualitatively different parts of the same world. And by this way, the mystical poem would be an permanent analysis of this strange nature of each language.
Experience through the use of incantations, through the use of mystery.
I'm not sure the term incantation would be the more exact one, because the incantation evokes a power, the possibility of an of a changing the beings or things. It's also true because for Juan de la Cruz, this system would be a key essential pedagogical method. You may understand our life only if you listen to this music. And the music, the musical structure of the language, is the basis for a teaching for Juan de la Cruz. But, and by this way, there would be something which would correspond to your incantation. But essentially, it's not this kind of thing. It's more the experience of the nature of the language itself. It's not first a power. There will be a power because this poem may unveil the nature of the language and this capacity of an understanding of the language by the poem or by its poetic use is more essential, and by this way the incantation function would be only secondary, only an effect of the true analysis or practice of the language. I don't know whether I am answering your question.
But you describe the star as a prison, right? In this poem, there's a tension between prison, a body, a framework, and a mystical experience,
yes,
which is by definition, cannot be defined.
Yes. But for example, it would be, if we take a linguistic reference, something relating to the basic distinction in our linguistic between language, lengua in Spanish, and speech, habla in Spanish. And the incantation, if we take again your word, would be the coming back of speech within the language, the coming back of habla within the lengua, as something which is escaping the systematic organization of a language, because in any rate, the language is systematically organized. It's a system, and for Juan de la Cruz, there is a very lucid and conscious recognition of this fact. But, and it would be the prison of language, as told Fred Jameson. But in this prison, there is something which is escaping. And it's essentially the fact that the language is also a speech. And the speech is something which has essentially a musical autonomy, escaping the system inside the system and not outside. It would be the relationship of the poem with the prison. And by this way, we have with Juan de la Cruz a kind of system which would be nearer, for example, Hieronymus Bosch system than Teresa de Avila's system. Teresa is first a chaotic invention, a movement without order. In the beginning, for Juan de la Cruz, there is an order. an institution. But inside, there is something which is different.
I wonder about the sufficiency of the model of the poem as a system of semantic echoes, in that whereas an echo posits two places and an answering, I think generally it also posits a kind of an originary voice or a generating voice. Whereas here, it seems to me, it's more an echo of echoes, in that your meaning is always referenced to, as in your use of amado in the present situation, but also to be found in Song of Songs. Mm. It's already a reference to a previous sounding of amado. Which is to say, you don't have, in this case, a simple echo, but the echoing of something that's previously resounded, and it's only re-resounding.
Yes, we will try to elaborate a little more this model, and I agree with you. It was a system of echoes because there is no source, only different places creating the possibility of an echo or reciprocally echo supposing different places, and they are relationship between those echoes, but there is no place for an origin of voice. For example, in we will see that the popular song, in the street, for example, there is a very nice story of Juan de la Cruz listening to child singing in the street when Juan de la Cruz was in jail, and there is an echo, a continuation of this poem in Juan de la Cruz poem, and there are also the biblical text or Garcilaso or many other sources, each one being an echo. But we must particularize this system, because I think that each word may be experimented as an echo of something different, a voice coming from another one. And in this system, when I am using one word, I am answering without knowing it, because my own world is already an echo of something present. But I don't know where is or what may be the origin, the first voice. There is no, this origin is unknown. It's to say that we have only this system of different echoes, or as you told, echoes of echoes, without knowing what may be the primitive voice. There is something which is speaking in each word, and using this word, I must use it as already an echo, something which is coming from elsewhere. And it's the same word for receiving another voice as an echo, and for answering. It's the same word. It's like we saw the text of the cloud of unknowing, a little word with one syllable. And in this word, we may recognize something which is speaking, and the only way for answering, the same word. is the same thing here. And the generalization of this experience will be the poetic conception of the language organized by Juan de la Cruz.
When you referred to Benjamin before, you indicated that as in Benjamin, there was at least a desire for some original source that would be the origin of the echoes. In terms of the problem of excess, I mean, the relationship between excess and the question of belief.
Yeah.
But in some sense, the direction of belief is towards that source that can't be named.
Mm-hmm. For example, for Benjamin, taking as an example Hölderlin's translation, the translation is not a direct relationship between Greek, for example, to German, but something which must be the coming of an invisible or an audible language in each language, a positive language. And we will see that the conception of Juan de la Cruz is something like that. There is something which is speaking either in the Bible, for example, or in his poems. And the poem may be the translation of the Song of Song because of their mutual relationship with a third, an audible language.
Well, this might be true of any communication. It's not only translation, it's
very interesting question, but what may be a communication?
Right.
Yeah. We know, for example, in a psychoanalytical way that finally there is no equivocity in a conversation. And maybe a communication begins when I recognize the permanent equivocity or ambiguity of my language. Is to say, by this way, I recognize the other as another person. Otherwise, there is the same positive meaning and there's no otherness. And the ambiguity, the equivocity of the language would be the mark of a real dialogue with another person.
I mean, the difficulty with that is then there would be no specificity to mystical belief and no historical dimension to the understanding of texts. That mysticism would be entirely demystified, it would be simply communication with all the problems of communication. That may be the result
well,
no, wants
no.
to come to, but that's the
yes,
rather...
Yes, but he's not saying that mysticism is going to be demystified, he's saying that any communication or any understanding, like in Gadamer's understanding, for example,
yeah.
any understanding of a book has to be somewhat mystified in a way.
Yeah.
It is taking place at a level that is not what we suppose it to be ordinarily.
Yeah.
And that any book is a Bible, you know. Like,
It also true for Juan de la Cruz, every flower or stone.
Right, and that's a mystical experience.
Yes. But the first distinction would be between, for example, a religious system and a mystical one. I think there are mystical procedures without religious reference and many religious institutions or discourses without mystical experience. And sometimes crossing between them. It's the case with Juan de la Cruz. But I think the formality of this mystical experience is not essentially connected with a religious historical figure. And it's also the difficulty for analyzing this kind of text, because I think that the frame, the vocabulary, the ideological material is essentially religious for Juan de la Cruz, no doubt about it. But the formality of this experience, no. And I think, even if it's too much elementary, that the monks were right putting Juan de la Cruz in prison because it effectively was very dangerous concerning the right of an institution to give a stable meaning to a discourse. If you suppress the institution, there is no more a stable meaning. It's the case here.
But I think there is a point to a historical uniqueness because this is a Spanish and a converso experience.
Mm.
And if you contrast this sort of communication with sort of this embodied image in Teresa's writing and the sort of echoing in Juan de la Cruz, if you contrast that to German mysticism, there is always a very clear sense of self and objective that you try to lose yourself in God. Then there is more or less a two-person dialogue and not this some disembodied, permanent.
Mm.
Do you see any direct inference on German system?
First, I definitely agree with your point that the fact that this mystical Spanish experience was essentially the expression of Jewish, not entirely Jewish, but Jewish experience within the Catholic language is essential. And for example, we may find the same thing in the Jewish German thinkers in 19th century when the Jews adopted the German culture as a frame of a new science. And the equivalent of Marx, Freud in 19th century German culture would be this mystical literature in the 16th Spanish culture. First point. But I think even if the Jewish origin is something which is very important for to understand in this system, it's not possible to limit this experience to the Jewish frame. For example, in the German mystical poetry of Angelus Silesius, we find exactly the same thing. Without the same security, which is a very interesting bit, because in Angelus Silesius we have the same system, but only as an open system. For example, the entire phonetic or poetic system and the mystical system of Angelus Silesius is put in the conditional. It's something which is desirable, which must be possible, but never affirmed as effective. There is no more the same security than in the 16th century Spanish mystics. But I think they the same value of phonetic structure and the echoes organization. For example, it's the essential desire of Angelus Silesius that something may speak within a language. The scripture is scripture, no more, nothing. There is a famous aphorism of the verb line of but what is essential is the possibility of speaking something. And in Angelus Silesius, the wonderful, the beautiful organization of a musical system is finally the substitute of this mystical experience. It's a hope. But I think the formality of the system is the same. And in Jacob Boehme, for example, we would have something like that still. And probably the Jewish Spanish experience of those 16th century mystics was the accentuation, or maybe the point of departure of this experience with something which was typically Spanish too, the game, the permanent game of different cultural languages, Arabic, Jewish, Castilian, And also the first Mediterranean language, Catalan language and Portuguese one. And I think the translation is a permanent feature of a mystical language. For example, the best, the deeper French mystical is an English person writing in sometimes in French, sometimes in English, in France, Benoît de Campfel. And this game on two languages, maybe two objective languages, or one explicit language and another one, an occulted language, is something which is permanently fundamental in this experience, because there is no absolute positive language. And for example, we have a very good, a very interesting example with the more, maybe the more philosophical mystic, is to say Nicolas Cusano in the 15th century. He's using the Latin language with typical German uses. And his characteristical conceptual vocabulary is made by those very strange German uses of Latin terms. Coincidence of opposite in the same word. And this way of suppressing the literal propriety and autonomy of a word by this internal introduction of phonetic echoes or semantic echoes is something which is a very characteristic of this kind of language.
For one, was the institution and the doctrine of the church part of the general corruption? In other words, was there a total rejection of the church as an institution and the doctrine of the church?
No. Sometimes, yes. For example, for many alumbrados in Spain in the 16th century, but it was not the case for Juan de la Cruz or for Teresa de Avila. But we have some very interesting topic first. The fact that for Teresa de Avila, and there was something like that less explicit with Juan de la Cruz, the goal was to live, to stay in a corrupted order. And it was for them the same thing that the gesture of immigrant monks in the 3rd century going to the desert, in the devil, evil, region. And it's a question of a proof, a test. You must be in the place where the struggle or the way of facing the enemy is more explicit. And I think the first gesture is not to have the security of a true place, but on the contrary, to find the best way of a confrontation. It was also the first gesture of Teresa de Avila to go to the Islamic country for becoming a martyr. Second thing, the fact that the church, even if corrupted, is the historical place of a truth. Even if its language is no more true, or if there are many people, ecclesiastical authorities, lying. The historical positivity of the church is the place of truth. And the essential confrontation, for example, for Juan de la Cruz or for Teresa de Avila, will be not exactly with the true expression given or presented by the church, but with the historical positivity of the church. is the reason why I told that for Teresa de Avila, and is true also, I think, for Juan de la Cruz, the church is a principle of reality more than a principle of truth. The truth is given to each one by something which is escaping every institution. There is no guarantee. But the historical reality of the church, authorities, institution, must be respected as a reality. It would be something like the principle of reality with Freud.